Clint Hatton, founder of Big Bull Brave.
Can you tell me about your life journey?
Yeah, Mike, thank you for asking. And I really am excited to have this conversation with you today. I've had a very interesting life and journey. I feel like it's multi-layered is probably the way to describe it. And I'm sure a lot of us feel that way. But for me, I grew up in sunny Southern California and had what I consider to be just kind of a normal childhood. Played a lot of sports, did good enough in school, that kind of stuff. So just very, very normal. And then by the time I was about 12 years old, there's some circumstances that happened that began to kind of shake things up and eventually would kind of form some of the experiences that I had going into my adulthood. And that was my parents got married very late. They were in their 30s by the time they got married. And my older brother, who's almost 8 years older, after they had him, my parents were told that my mom could never have children again. As a matter of fact, she had a partial hysterectomy. And so they were expecting that they would only have one child. And then here I am. So 8 years later, boom, they get this, what they consider to be a miracle baby, and I came into the world. But when I was about 12, they had already been married over 25 years. And my mom, they got married when he was 18, she was 16. This is kind of coming out of the Korean War, so a very different era from what we know today. And so my mom, that was the only man that she knew. And my dad ended up cheating on her, ended up moving out on us. By then, my brother, who was considerably older, as I just described, he had already moved away several hundred miles. So it was just her and I. And it didn't go well. And over the next 2 years, there was kind of this up and down, crazy journey. My mom, they had always had parties and would drink, but I wouldn't say they were heavy drinkers. She didn't, get hammered. But during that season, she just wasn't able to cope very well and started drinking very heavily. Ended up having what we now call suicidal ideation. She tried committing suicide on multiple occasions, pills, different things. And then a couple of those times she actually almost killed me with her. One time was she was drunk. I couldn't drive. We were going home from having dinner somewhere, and she literally turned to me and said, I'm just going to end it all for both of us. And we ended up spinning at about 65 miles an hour on a very dangerous two-lane road where I grew up. Where a lot of fatalities had happened. And fortunately, obviously for us, we didn't hit a tree or anything. We just literally spun and safely came to a stop. And then later on, another time, she had a handgun and we had to wrestle it away from her. And, so there were some scary things that happened when I was 12 that, really rocked my world and began to kind of change my worldview, if I could say it that way. And specifically what I mean by that is I really became very independent. I think out of guilt, by the way, let me say this up front and we can move on with the story. My parents did end up after about a 2 year cycle of all this crazy stuff, reconciling. And they went on to actually be married for 65 years. Both of them passed away just 6 months apart from one another in their 80s, about 8 years ago. And actually, by the time I got into my probably 19, 20 years old and beyond, had a really good relationship with my parents. So that all kind of worked itself out. But what I didn't recognize is just the subconscious damage in particular that those experiences had done to me. We'd even moved, Mike, from sunny Southern California, right? I'm a Southern California kid. And one of the times in the middle of this cycle when they reconciled, they decided, well, we just need to get away from everything, as a lot of people do, right? They think, well, we can just run from our problems. And so they bought 20 acres out in the middle of absolutely nowhere, Southern Montana, and had a log cabin built. And so we moved there over the summer. I had hair back in those days down to about my shoulder. Which doesn't sound like a big deal unless you're in 1978-ish, I think, and you're showing up to rural Montana looking that way. So the kids, there did not receive me well. It was a pretty brutal time in my life. So we spent 3 months there with the intention that that's where we were going to live. And he actually ended up getting on a plane one day when we thought he was going to work and took off and left us and got back with that other woman. So we ended up selling the property within 24 hours. I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy ride. And so even though we reconciled, I didn't recognize just how much damage that had done with me. And so I think just to kind of speed through things and get to where I am today, what that ended up causing was subconsciously, you know, especially if I was in a romantic relationship and anything even sniffed of infidelity, you know, someone cheating on me, a girlfriend, whatever, then that is one thing that would really set me off. I was generally a pretty happy-go-lucky guy, positive guy. You know, most people would back in those days say I was kind of the life of the party, you know, that kind of stuff. But if I was in a relationship and I felt like someone may cheat on me, or in many cases just assumed that they would, you know, it would change my behavior. And I could get mean, I could get nasty. And, you know, it was a part of me that I knew I didn't like. But in those days, you know, I really had no reference point of how to change it. Really, you know, I wasn't surrounded with people that were what I would say today is, you know, growth minded. And so, you know, you tend to attract people that are more like you. And I just kind of stayed in that cycle, you know, for many, many years and up and down relationships. there's one part of this story that I don't enjoy telling because it's definitely a little embarrassing, but I even got engaged a couple of times. One of those only lasted about 24 hours. And, you know, relationships was just a complete disaster. So fast forward, I ended up getting married eventually, you know, the third time actually I'd got engaged, I ended up getting married, and we were both train wrecks. You know, I mean, I just gave you some of the small parts of why I was not a healthy individual. I didn't even include yet that I had about a 9-year stretch when I started to get in the car business and sales where I abused meth and many other drugs and alcohol, you know, so I had that going on. And so, you know, we get married, she's got all of her issues, and it was not made a match made in heaven. We'll put it that way. And so we made it almost 5 years, but the turning point for me was it started with, you know, I wasn't making the kind of money that I felt like I could make. And I knew if I continued to do what I was doing, which at that time I was selling appliances at, in that particular season of my life. And so I ended up getting involved with a network marketing company, and it was a nutritional company. And even though I just described to you, you know, I've abused drugs and alcohol and stuff like that, I was an athlete all my life. I still kept in reasonably good shape. So I valued nutrition, even though I was doing crazy stuff. So I get involved with this company. And the reason why that ended up being significant is it wasn't so much about even the money that I started to make or even, you know, the type of future that I may have through that. It was really all of the trainings that I went to, which were largely workshops that were all around mindset and, you know, really digging into what you truly believe in your deepest core and why you respond the way you do to problems, and, you know, why you have, whether it's anger issues or whatever. You know, there was a lot of really high level training on mindset. And that was something that I had never experienced. And along with that, you know, when you're surrounded by people that are growth minded, that, you know, want to become a better version of themselves for whatever their reason is, then that tends to kind of, you know, pull something out of you. And so I really began to think, man, I can be a totally different person. And so ultimately that led me to, by then I wasn't using meth all the time, but I was still using it. And I remember the very last time I ever used it, I was 30 years old. And actually my ex-wife, we didn't make it, by the way, the spoiler alert, you know, we had both done it together. And I woke up the next day, Mike, and, you know, anybody that's listening to this, that's ever had that part of their story where they've done meth or any really hard, hard drugs, it's not like you ever wake up feeling great. You know, that's just not a byproduct of drug abuse. So it's not like that was any different. I woke up not feeling great, but there was something different mentally about the way I was thinking about not feeling great. And I just made a decision that day that I'm done. I'm never doing meth again. I don't want this to be a part of my life. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that kind of go into that kind of a lifestyle that I was just done with, you know, partly just the fact that it's illegal. You know, I'd put myself in many environments trying to acquire the drugs that I could have been arrested. You know, there's a lot of fact. Could have died, I don't know how many times. So I made a decision, I'm done. And I was done. And that was almost, 28 years ago now, and never went back, you know. So that was kind of the beginning. It was really being surrounded with people who saw things in me that I didn't see myself, and beginning to shift into this idea of growth mindset versus I'm a victim to my past. I'm a victim to bad decisions. I'm a victim to the things I've experienced, you know. And so ultimately, you know, in my marriage, we got a divorce, as I said a second ago. And then, you know, I'm a man of faith. I was a pastor for 17 years. So, you know, I'll just throw that out there now too. And so for me, a big part of what changed my life was when I accepted a relationship with God too. And that happened for me less than a year after I decided to quit meth. And so that was 1999. And so that began to, you know, really have me take a hard look at morally how I was living and, you know, what kind of value was I bringing to this world? You know, was I finding ways to serve people, or was everything just about me? You know, those kinds of things. That's what a relationship with God and Christianity really, I feel like, did for me. That was the a really positive thing. And so that began my journey. And then, you know, I ended up being a pastor for 17 years, full-time ministry, actually for 22, because I didn't start as a pastor. And then what, you know, we're kind of speeding through things now, but when I got involved in ministry, that's where I met my bride of almost 21 years today. And when we came together, that's a whole other story. We've done actually podcast episodes together, and those usually run about an hour and a half, because our story of getting together is a whole story in and of itself. So we won't go there today, but it's a fascinating part of just, you know, our life. And but what led me to where I am today and where we're going to ultimately go with some of our conversation was those experiences, you know, really made me so aware of who you surround yourself with, the kinds of things that you think about and meditate on. And, you know, again, just, I don't want to overuse the word or the phrase growth mindset, but just the idea of always wanting to be a better version of yourself was pretty deeply implanted in me. Now, I didn't do any of that perfectly. You know, like anybody, I would have months or probably even some years if I took time to go back and really think hard about it, where I didn't pursue those things like I should have. But it was still in there, and I had had a process over the years of making some positive changes just in the way I live my life. So then fast forward, you know, we're married, we've got children. As of 2019, which is where I'm going to take a dramatic shift in our story, we had three boys. And in 2019, my oldest son, Gabriel, some things happened with him that really dramatically impacted our lives as a family and drove me to do the things that I'm doing today. And that is simply, you know, he loved aviation. He went up in a small aircraft when he was about 8 years old with his Uncle Danny and just loved it. You know, it's one of those things where maybe for someone else, it's going to a Major League Baseball game, or maybe for someone else, it's going to a Broadway play, or, you know, whatever, where you're in this environment and you're doing something you've never done before, and it just gets in your blood and you're like, I have to do this the rest of my life, you know? And that's what happened. And so, you know, at eight, no big deal. And you're just kind of thinking, yeah, well, next week you may want to, you know, play in the NBA. But he never let go of it. And so by the time 2019 rolls around, he had gotten involved in this club that afforded him the opportunity to actually pursue his private pilot's license. He actually soloed when he was 16 before he even had a driver's license, which was crazy and fun and, you know, all that stuff. And then at 17, which is the youngest you can be, he ended up applying for and he passed the exam to get his private pilot's license, the check ride, all that stuff. And he became a private pilot. And on September 23rd of 2019, he had been flying all that year. He was racking up his hours, which is what you're doing. He had begun his instrument rating training and was killing it. He had actually started college as well, taking some college classes because he had graduated a year early. You know, just really a high achiever, super courageous, just going for it, living his dream. And we were so excited for him. And he took a trip. He went to Arkansas, which is a little bit north of us where I live in the Dallas, Texas area now. a flight he had done before. He drops off a really good friend. That's why he went up there. He took her back to school to drop her off. And on his return flight, he ended up running into what the NTSB would rule. It took a couple of years to get the report, but that he had gone through an unexpected weather system through a little mountain range that he was passing through. And he ended up suffering from spatial disorientation, which, a lot of the listeners won't necessarily know what that is. Most people are familiar with the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash because of obvious reasons how famous he was. And, and here you had that guy, I believe, if I remember right, had over 50,000 hours in a $1 million helicopter with all the instruments. And Gabriel was a new pilot without the instruments. And so he lost his horizon is what that means. And you think you're flying up and you're flying down. And he flew into a mountainside and lost his life. And so it was an absolutely devastating blow to us as a family. His younger brothers were 9 and 14 at the time. And so, that absolutely changes your life forever. And there's a lot of things we could talk about depending on where you want to go with that. But ultimately, where it leads into who I am today, I like to say it this way because I believe this is really my truth. And that is, when I began to examine the way Gabriel went about his life, and, I've already given you some things about him, but he wanted to learn guitar. And so he started watching YouTube videos. We didn't even know he was doing it. And then one night, there's an electric guitar you can actually see behind me. We hear this rock riff from the 80s that was very recognizable and it sounded live. And we're like, did you hear that? Because his room is on the opposite side of our living room. So we both come running over and we're like, open the door. And he's jamming on the guitar. And we're like, when did you learn how to play guitar? And he's like, oh, I've been watching YouTube videos. I've just been practicing, And he became an incredible photographer. Actually got hired to do some professional gigs, even though that wasn't his main thing. So, I just looked at how courageous he was. If he thought about doing something, it was a done deal. And maybe he'd do it and not end up liking it. And, maybe that's the end of that. But he was not going to let fear or an aversion to risk keep him from doing something that he felt like he wanted to do or try. And I had. And I called myself a coward. I wrote a book, which we may talk about later in the book. I called myself a coward. Not in every area. Listen, people that are listening to this story, I hope you're hearing your own story in this. I hope you're not just focusing on just me and my experience. I hope you're hearing your story in this. And it was such a powerful awakening for me because I had pockets of my life where I had acted with courage and I was doing some good things and I was doing things that brought me joy. But there were other areas that I had thought about for years. One of those was writing a book. I had been asked by people around me in my circles for almost 15 years, with parts of my story and just certain things that I've done, when are you going to write a book? When are you going to write a book? And frankly, I was always a little afraid to, and always made excuses why, the world doesn't need another book, stuff like that. And then also with the idea of beginning to do speaking engagements in the corporate world and doing executive coaching, not just stuff in the church. Those were all dreams I had, Mike. And I had never done anything to step out into those. I just kept doing the same thing over and over and over, year after year after year. And, when you let your dreams like that lay dormant long enough, they're not a dream anymore. They're just nothing more than a fantasy, right? They're just something that's never going to happen. That just seems like this, what would be this really cool thing out there somewhere, but I'm not willing to do the work. And so it just remains a fantasy. And so that's what losing him, or part of what losing him, did to me. And so that's when I started making some changes and I started pursuing some new things. I started learning some new things. And so today, as I'm sitting here with you, I still, I'm a man of faith. I'm still involved in volunteering for my church that I belong to. So I do speak in churches and do that kind of thing still. But I became an executive coach. I'm working with a company called Excellent Cultures that's been doing some amazing things for, I think it's 37 years now in the corporate world. And I'm doing what I call transformational speaking. So I've had the incredible opportunity to speak for a leadership event with Starbucks and I've done some stuff with Westinghouse Electric, and I got one coming up with Safeco. So, you know, some big Fortune 150 companies. And but, you know, none of those opportunities would have ever happened had I not been willing to take a hard look at my life. And I know, I don't know how much you want to tell your story, but we had an off-camera conversation. So I know you can totally relate to what I'm talking about, because you were very successful in your industry, and then you decided there were components of it that just weren't feeding you. And then that's right. Why you launched out to do what you're doing, right? So I know you can totally relate with me. And I'm sure there's so many people that are watching and listening to this that feel the same way. And so I launched out and I started doing those things. And so these opportunities are starting to come, and it's really been an amazing ride. So that's kind of the shotgun blast, if you will, my story. And so I'm going to bounce it back to you and just see, you know, where we're going to go with this.
Yeah. So everything you do to help others, how does that help your healing process?
Yeah, that's a great question and kind of a statement too, because it does. And as I describe my experience, I want to say this up front, because the reality of it is there's very likely, if not absolutely, it's assured that there's going to be people watching and listening to this that have suffered a very hard loss. And it may not be exactly like mine. It may not be the loss of a child, which, you know, I get asked all the time, well, you know, that has to be the worst possible loss there is. Well, it's pretty unimaginable, but comparing loss is a really bad game, you know, and the truth is loss is loss. And it could be a divorce. It could be losing a career. It could be losing a business that you worked 25 years to build, and overnight, you know, the pandemic comes in and wipes you out, or, you know, whatever. Loss is loss, and it's devastating. But you know, there's something about making a decision that in your loss, you're going to find ways to serve other people, whatever that looks like. It is very cathartic, and it does help you, you know. And for us, it actually happened right out the chute. You know, Gabriel was just shy of 18 years old. So he had just graduated from high school. So he had a lot of friends that were still in high school. He had a lot of friends that had just started college. Because of his work in that club that he was a part of in the aviation industry. I mean, it was really crazy, Mike. We didn't even know until after he passed away some of the relationships he built. I mean, he had relationships with like presidents of aviation companies and, you know, all these different things through his mentor, who is a really well-known guy in the aviation industry. And so, you know, he had this like crazy span of relationships and impact. And so we had to recognize, and I really do think this is a key, and I'm hoping people that maybe are suffering right now can maybe just try to hear me through your pain, because we were in extreme pain in those early days and weeks and months. And we still suffer pain today. It was a little over 4 years ago. We have lots of painful moments of, you know, being very aware that he's not with us, and birthdays and different things. So please understand, I'm not talking about, you know, well, you just push the pain aside and you don't deal with it. We can talk about that in a second. But there was something about recognizing other people were in pain too, and what could we do to help that? And so two quick examples, and I'll tell you how it helped us, was one was the girl who was his passenger and her mother. They were very, besides just being incredibly emotionally distraught with the experience itself, and that, you know, he passed away after dropping her off, she began to have what many call a survivor complex. You know, why just him? Why not me too? And then the mother's like, well, what if we'd have never asked him to take her back to school? You know, all that stuff was going on. And so we had found out that they were really struggling the morning after the accident. So within a couple hours, we had them, you know, in our home, and just kind of talking them through. And first of all, they thought we hated them because they're the reason this happened, you know, and all the stuff that I understand naturally why that runs through people's minds, but it's a lie. It's not true. You know, the truth was he took her in that aircraft because he loved it. It was his dream. It was his life, you know, he needed more hours. I mean, there was purpose in it too, you know? And so we had some conversations, and by the end of it, you know, we're able to bring a measure of healing to them. Well, when you bring a measure of healing to other people, it's an absolute byproduct of that, that you receive a degree of healing as well. You may not get the fullness of it. That can take time. And I believe, you know, honestly, when you talk about healing, I believe we're going to be healing on some level the rest of our lives. Because you're talking about our son. You know, we've never prayed for the pain to go away either. We've learned how to manage our emotions, but we've never asked for the pain to go away, because for us, the pain just simply represents who he was to us. You know, the relationship that we had and the love we had for him and he had for us. So, but back to your question, I'm sorry, I don't want to get off on a rabbit trail here, but there is something very real, very tangible about when you, I won't even say set aside your pain, because we were in major pain. I would say that when you're willing to look beyond your own pain and see others around you where you have an opportunity, even if it's just one time in one moment for 2 minutes, to bring some sort of healing to them, it's going to bring a measure of healing for you. I could give you a ton of examples of that, but they all kind of come back to that same principle.
Yeah, you talked about it earlier, but can you talk about the process of writing a book?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, well, I can talk about my process, right?
Yes,
I'm sure it's,
of course, yes.
It's not the same for everybody, and I'd be glad to kind of describe how that came about and you know, how I did it. But, you know, I want to say this up front, because I sincerely mean this. And my publisher, who happens to be a personal friend too, also believes this, and that is, I think everybody should write a book. And what I mean by that is not necessarily even to publish, and not to try and write a bestseller or, you know, to try and sell to make money or anything like that. There is something very powerful about just the process of writing a book and putting things down. And, you know, I actually know people who have written a book just for their own family, just with no intentions of really doing anything with it, you know. Which incidentally, if you don't know the story, the book, The Shack, which most people are familiar with, that's exactly what he did to begin with. He had no intentions of ever publishing that book. And I think most of us probably know where that went, you know, it became a massive bestseller. But for me, you know, again, I'd already described earlier, I'd had people ask me over the years and I thought, well, I know there's, you know, interesting parts to my story that maybe somebody would find interesting. And so I'd had all those thoughts, but when, after Gabriel passed away, and we're talking, you know, probably about a year and a half after, so I really originally didn't intend on writing a book so quickly in the grieving process. And there was a couple of reasons for that specific to my book. One is I knew I wanted to write about his story and include it into our family story and just certain experiences that I've had, but I didn't want it to be solely through the lens of grieving, even though I knew it would include it. So that was hurdle number one, that I needed a little bit of time. And then secondly, you know, I don't know how many people have thought about when I gave the date, but he passed away on September 23rd, 2019. In January of 2020 is when the entire world got rocked with COVID. So within just a few months of his passing, we were going through all of it with everybody else, right? And so obviously, we were all trying to figure out how we adjusted to this crazy world and, you know, the lockdowns and quarantines and rules and, you know, all the stuff that everybody on the planet was dealing with. So it was about a year and a half into it, I began to feel like, okay, I've got some bandwidth. I feel like I can begin to write this. And I think what was really important, I think this is important to anybody who's considering writing a book, is what's the point at the end of the day? You know, especially if you're looking at publishing a book to help people, what is the point? Why am I even going to do this? And what I was just so, I'm going to use a strong word here, I was so disgusted with the amount of fear that had been unleashed on our planet. And for me, that's not a political statement, so I'm not going to get into a rant on one side of, you know, the any political aisles, decisions that were made. I think new information is coming out every day. So even people who may have thought one way, maybe you're thinking a different way now, whatever. I'm just saying no one I've talked to, no matter how they experienced the pandemic, doesn't think that fear was unleashed on our planet in ways we've never seen before. Right. And then the isolation has its own impact from a mental standpoint. And we're seeing the outflow of that, even though some decisions were made with the best intentions. Right. So I really felt like, okay, I have a direction. My direction is I'm going to write a book that honors my son's life and his bravery. And that's why it's called Big Bull Brave and attacking life and not letting fear getting in your way. And so it's a little bit of both. There's parts of it that describe our grieving processes and some of the very healthy things that we have done and continue to do that would help anybody through any kind of traumatic event. But it's bigger than that. It's about a mindset. It's about the way I deal with the challenges that come to my life. Because, you know, we all recognize we got punched in the gut in a way with Gabriel's death that can't be replicated. But we've certainly been dealt some blows since too. And we've been through some other stuff, you know. So that was the first part of it, Mike, was coming to a conclusion of, okay, why am I going to do this? And what's the end game? What am I trying to help people with? So that was number one. And then the second part came about kind of accidentally. And I would just say that's the courage just to get started. Because a lot of times when it comes to writing a book or starting a business or changing, you know, the trajectory of your career, right? It's just getting started that can be really tough. And through a strange...
Oh, yeah, big time.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And so through kind of a strange series, I don't know if strange is the right word, but interesting series of events, the final catalyst to kind of push me over the edge was my wife was listening to a podcast on a guy named Ed Milet, who I'm very familiar with now, but I didn't know who Ed Milet is. And he's, you know, definitely very well known in the personal development space. And he's got a pretty big podcast. But she had told me about it because of the guy that he happened to be interviewing that day because she had started listening to it. And it was a guy by the name of Howard Behar. Now, a lot of people don't know Howard Behar by name, but everybody on planet Earth knows what he's famous for. And so he's talking, and I'm going to tell you what it is in a second, but so he's on this interview and I'm just hearing him talk about leadership and how to, you know, really treat people, and especially as a leader, how to treat people and how you can bring out the gold in people and all this stuff that I just loved. And so at the end of it, he ends up giving out. I really have rarely ever seen this. I don't do this, and I'm not famous by any stretch. At the end of the podcast interview, when Ed asked him, you know, how can people connect with you? He gave out his phone number and his email address. You know, email is one thing, but he gave out his phone number too. You're personal right. Phone number, you know? And I'm like, this dude's crazy, you know? But that's what he did. So I logged it. And then I decided I wanted to reach out. So here's why. Here's why I wanted to reach out to this guy. Howard Behar he's retired now, but he's the former president of Starbucks International. He was hired by Howard Schultz very early on. They were only, I want to say it was 28, but it was a small number of stores compared to today, primarily just in the Pacific Northwest. And Howard Schultz hired Howard Behar as part of his team, and he took over. And with his leadership, and he's the one who actually launched all of their international business. Like I said, he became the president of the international arm and built them to the behemoth that you see today, you know. And so I reached out to him through an email, just appreciating the things he talked about. And he had promised he would get back to everybody, but it would take some time. Well, 3 months later go by, I'd totally forgotten about it. And then one day I wasn't even feeling well. I'm sitting at my office desk and I'm having a pity party. And then I thought, Howard Behar never got back to me. He said he would get back to everybody. I'm not going to let that go, which was definitely not my old self. My old self would have just let all that stuff go because I never pursued people, right? No matter what famous, not famous, didn't matter. But I decided to do that. So I sent him back a quick email and just basically said something like, hey, I'm sure my email may have gotten lost in cyberspace, but I never heard back from you. Just thought you should know. Yeah. 3 minutes go by, and this is a true story, Mike. This is exactly what happened. Because remember, he had given out his phone number, so I had it logged in my phone. 3 minutes go by, and he must have just been on his computer, and my phone starts ringing, and it's Howard Behar, former president of Starbucks. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know. So I won't bore everybody with the details of our conversation. It wasn't super long. It was, I don't know, I want to say 10 minutes, maybe 15, but it was short. But in that conversation, he asked me a little bit about my story, a little bit about, what I'm doing. And he asked me the question. He goes, have you written the book? And I was almost kind of embarrassed. You know, I'm like, ah. I said, no. And so he spent a few minutes telling me from his perspective why I absolutely needed to write the book. And then at the end of it, he asked me, this is a teachable moment for everybody listening to me tell this story. Again, I hope as I'm telling my story, you're not thinking about just me, you're thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity that I was not prepared for, and we need to think bigger. So I'm on this conversation with him, and at the end of it, he asked me, Clint, how can I help you? What can I do for you? And Mike, I was like stunned. I was not prepared to answer that question. And I should have been. And I didn't try to fake it. I didn't try to, put one over on Howard and make something up on the spot. I literally told him, Howard, I didn't expect you. First of all, I never expected you to call me. So I wasn't expecting a phone call tonight. And I said, in second, I was ill-prepared to answer that question. Because frankly, as you're asking me that question, I'm kind of embarrassed that I don't really have a good answer, but I don't. So I really don't know. But I tell you what, I am committing tonight that I'm going to write this book. And so I will ask you that favor. If I write it, will you do me the honor of reading it? And he said, yes, I will. I said, okay. So to fast forward, Howard Behar ended up not only reading my book, but then I asked him later, I know it's probably impossible for anybody to see, but he ended up actually writing the foreword to my book. Oh, and wow. So, so it ended up being a really cool thing for me, but I want people to hear that and just know that first, I had to have a strong why. But then the second is you need people around you that are going to be encouraging, that kind of push you over the edge. And that's really, Howard wasn't the first one to encourage me to write a book. My wife had done it. I don't know how many times I had friends who had, but he was kind of that final nudge. And then I want to suggest to you that your story matters. And maybe it's not a book. Maybe you do a podcast interview with a topic that interests you, and you're just a stay-at-home mom or dad, or you're in the corporate world or whatever. But you need to know your story matters, and your story is going to speak to somebody. And there's elements of your story that you think are so normal that they're not really even significant. And the truth is in someone else hearing it, you're going to encourage them. You're going to inspire them. You're going to, say something that changes the way they think, that could completely change the trajectory of their life. And so that's why I launched out and decided to write the book. And I could tell you about the process if you're interested in that, and just how I approached writing a book, having never been an author before. But that's ultimately what led me to do it. And I've been so grateful I did.
So what do you do to help your own mental health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to give you some things that I do. And I'm also going to describe to you some things that we actually did very early on. And when I say early on, I mean like literally the morning after Gabriel's accident, that we implemented, that at that time we weren't consciously aware that it was a healthy mechanism for your mental health, especially when it comes to grieving a loss. But I would find out later, because I became a complete nerd when it comes to neuroscience and the science of the mind and the way that we think and the way we process our emotions and thoughts and beliefs and all that kind of stuff, which has led me to the kind of stuff I'm doing today. But as far as for my own mental health, it started that first morning. I had to have what was, I call it the impossible conversation. I mean, it truly is a complete nightmare to lose a child in such a in such a, you know, abrupt way, and then have to turn around and tell, in my case, his two younger brothers who saw him as bigger than life, that he was gone because they had slept through the night. We had a very long night. He had disappeared off of radar. It was several hours of just agonizing hell, getting conflicting reports because it was in a rural area, until we finally actually found out and we'd let our boys sleep through the night. So that next morning when we sat down, I mentioned earlier, I'm a believer. And so, you know, I did ask for help. I asked God to help me, you know, what do I say? And I really felt like he gave me an answer. And so what I told them was, I said, listen, boys, and this is part of addressing the story of your mental health and how you see things that are happening to you. I said, listen, we have two choices in how we're going to begin to walk this out. And it's a journey. It's not this is not like I'm going to say this and then we're all good. This is going to be part of our journey, right? And the two choices are, we can choose to look at this tragedy and just, you know, the awful aspects of it, of losing him in a plane crash, you know, and knowing that he's not going to be able to, you know, he's never going to get married. He's never going to build a business like he had talked about doing, you know, all these things that we weren't going to experience. If we focus solely on the pain and the tragedy, then that was going to inform the rest of our lives. And we were going to be a shadow of who each of us were created to be and what we were, you know, created to do. So I told them the second choice is this. And I said it in a little bit simpler terms, because I know we have a mature audience. You know, they were 9 and 14. But I basically told them, Gabriel lived his life courageously. He never let fear get in the way. He chased his dreams. And as, you know, as painful as this is that we lost him, we do know that he was living it out. And many people live their entire lives and never even try, let alone live out their dream. And so I told him the second way is that we're going to choose to honor the way he lived by choosing to live the same way ourselves. And that didn't mean we were going to fly a plane or chase his dreams. That just meant that we were going to, as a family, make a decision that we were going to chase our dreams and we were going to do it together. And then the second part of that, which was also part of, because that's the story that you begin to tell yourself about what's going on, which is going to be a huge factor in your mental wellness and what you experience as time goes on, processing whatever it is that you're needing to process, right? And I understand there's chemical agents to this and different things that happen biologically. I'm not talking about those specifically. Sometimes those need to be addressed medically. I'm talking about what's in your control. The second piece was, I said, you know, we don't know what the grieving process is going to feel like for us individually, as a family, and on a day-to-day basis, because it's not going to be equal every day. Every day is not going to be the same. So we made a commitment to one another that we were going to have, I now call them courageous conversations. We didn't have that term for it back then, but I've tried to kind of package things in a way that makes sense to anybody. But these courageous conversations simply meant we were not going to allow each other to go on day after day after day without, and I'm going to use the word aggressively, not in a like physically, you know, forcing somebody aggressiveness, but in an aggressive way, in the sense that we were going to actively ask each other on a frequent basis how we were doing, even when it looked like maybe we were doing pretty good that day. Which I think is a really important part of when you start talking about managing your own mental health and trying to be aware of maybe the mental health going on in those around you, right? Because one of the things that we've learned so much about in terms of, you know, when you look at suicide, one of the most painful, difficult things about people who have processed someone who they've lost to suicide is so many times there hasn't been anything obvious on the surface. It's not always the person who looks dejected and depressed. And, you know, sometimes that person can learn to put on kind of a front and hide it. And meanwhile, there's a real deep pain. So, you know, I felt like that mechanism that we put in place that morning, and then we've done it time after time. And Mike, we haven't done it perfectly either. You know, we've messed up and we've went too long without asking the question. And so we've, you know, allowed one or the other to suffer more than maybe we should have or whatever. So I'm not talking about doing this stuff perfectly, but I'm just talking about having some intentional things in place that you do with some consistency that keep you on track to maintaining, you know, a healthy mental state and processing things as life hits you in the face. So we made that commitment. And like I said, I think obviously when we saw it on each other, it was important because, you know, especially heavy grieving, anybody who's been around someone or has experienced it, in those early weeks, it's pretty easy to pick up on, right? Because loss does so many things to you. It injures your spirit and your soul. It can mess with the way you think. You know, it took me well over a year to even begin to even think straight the way I used to think. I've always been kind of an ordered person in certain ways, and there's a lot of things that just I tended to remember to do that I didn't even necessarily have to put on a calendar, for example. But all of a sudden, I wasn't even remembering to put things on a calendar, right? There's all these aspects of deep grieving or trauma that you're dealing with. And so we would, if we saw it on each other, we would ask a question. And for us, and this is my recommendation, that you have some sort of a safe word or phrase that's easy to remember and easy to ask. And ours was as simple as this: how are you doing with Gabriel? So if it was obvious, we'd have the conversation. Then there may be another day, and this is why I call it courageous conversations, Mike, and why this is so critical, no matter which side of this you're on, in terms of, you know, helping the humans around you try to maintain a healthy mental health state, is one of us, it could have been her, it could have been me, because it's happened in both directions, maybe going throughout the day, and my wife and I tend to talk in the evening, and so not that we don't talk at all during the day, but we have our deeper conversations at night. And we may have gone through the day where there was joy and laughter and maybe something good happened in our business. She's an artist. Maybe she sold a painting, you know, whatever. And so at the end of that day, you could sit down and look at each other and you may assume that everything's good because of just the particular body language that you're seeing in the moment, right? And throughout the day. And it's risky and it takes courage to ask, because sometimes you don't want to rock your own emotional boat, right? Like, I'm feeling good. And if I ask this person the question and they're not actually feeling good, and let's say they have a meltdown, that's going to kill my good, right? And so it takes courage. So we would ask that question. And sometimes we'd say, oh, I'm doing pretty good today, you know? And we may even have a joyful moment. But then there were other times where, whether it was her, whether it was me, and this facade showed everything was fine, everything wasn't fine. And we would break down. And then in that breakdown, you know, we would, if it was a conversation, we would have a conversation about it. And sometimes it was just sitting in it, you know. Sometimes it was just letting each other cry. And there was really nothing to say. But those were two things very early on that we have repeated over time that I believe have been really critical. And then I really don't want to jump off this topic until I at least say one more thing. And then I would of course invite any other questions, because you may be thinking on different planes than I am right now. But, you know, there's another piece to it, especially again, as kind of a neuroscience geek. And one thing we know about the human mind, the mind in particular, our brain in relationship to the rest of our body and even our emotional states, that eating well and exercise, even physical weights, and I'm not talking about becoming, you know, a Greek god or, you know, a bodybuilder. I'm just talking about resistant training, right? We know now that's one of the best things you can do for brain health. It's not even arguable. There's too many studies out there now. So that's another piece that I would say, because we were people who worked out before, so it wasn't like we had to be convinced of that just to go work out. But we weren't able to for probably about a month, month and a half, just because of the overall toll that grieving was taking on us. We just simply didn't have the energy to do it. But we got to a point that both of us just kind of looked at each other, and, you know, fortunately for us, it was at the same time. We're like, okay, we need to start doing it again. And our goal wasn't even, you know, to necessarily get back to the shape we were in a month and a half ago. It was more so, we know this needs to be a part of our routine to help our brain health, to help our emotional state. And so, and we don't eat perfectly either. I don't want, you know, that can be kind of a buzzkill for many people out there, right? It's like, well, I don't know. What would I rather have? Really good mental health, or do I want to still have pizza and ice cream? And, you know, I'm not saying it's this or that, right? You know, but we do eat mostly healthy things to feed our brain, and we'll intentionally eat foods that we know feed our brain. And then we just limit the bad stuff. It's not like we don't still eat bad stuff. We do. We just limit it. So those three things are definitely foundational and continuous to us maintaining our mental health as we, you know, again, not just continue to grieve our son from time to time when those feelings surface, because triggers can come from anywhere at any time, but also just with the other gut punches that are going to happen in life.
What would you, with, I like that you said gut punches, yeah, because that brings me to my next question. What would you say to anyone going through a tough time?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few things that I would say. Well, the first thing is it's okay to admit that you're going through a tough time. That may sound really basic, but the truth is a lot of people are trained, especially depending on what generation they grew up with their parents. Like my parents came from, again, they were kind of the post-Korean War genre. And so when we dealt with stuff, my dad was the kind that, like, if you got an injury playing a sport, you know, it was like tape an aspirin to it or rub dirt on it, you know. It was just suck it up, like kind of pretend like it's not there. And that generation often dealt with emotions the same way, right? And so if you've been raised by someone like that, or you've been raised by someone who's raised by someone like that and, you know, has some other maybe not so healthy coping mechanisms, those things really form how you handle challenges. So I do think it really is important. The first thing you need to do is it's okay to recognize what I'm experiencing, and it's a negative thing or it's unwanted, undesirable, whatever that is. Nothing wrong with that. The challenge we run into is when you allow that to become so embedded into your subconscious mind, because that's all you're thinking about is the problem and the gut punch and the thing that came back, you know, that has attacked you in some way in life, then you're not able to look outside of that. You only experience the emotions of the, you know, whether it's trauma, whether it's confusion, whether it's fear, whatever the emotion that's attached to that particular thing that you're dealing with, it makes it very difficult to problem solve, right? So I would say the first thing is admit what it is, but then be solution oriented. That's a growth mindset. That's someone who has practiced the concept of constantly reframing the story that you tell yourself about what you're currently experiencing, and that whatever it is, we can be, you know, cutesy about it. I can make, you know, lemonade out of lemon, you know, whatever it is, that solutions are everywhere. And I just need to put my energies now into finding that solution. Now, with that, I want to add, you may not be able to do that all alone. And I would venture to say that most of the time you're not going to be able to do that completely alone when you're dealing with a really difficult gut punch. So you're going to want to have, whether it's, you know, really close friendships, whether it's a mentor of some kind, it's a professional coach, whatever, a pastor, if you're a person of faith, you know, you need those people in your life that you can share what you're going through, partly just to be able to listen to you, and then partly, if you're looking for solutions, to be able to bounce some things off of other people. Because, you know, sometimes the solutions are already in us, but because of the emotional state and just, again, when I say trauma now, I don't mean, you know, like something as extensive as losing your child or losing a career. Just the trauma of something just happened to me I wasn't expecting, and now what do I do? You know, when you have those things in your life, they make it available to you to be able to find solutions that are outside of where you're stuck, right? So I would say you want to have conversations with people. Again, this the funny thing is when you talk about this stuff, and you can talk to a lot of leaders. I did 70 podcast interviews alone last year with experts in this field. You know, a lot of what we say, the answers are really simple. They really are. I think the biggest challenge of it all is just most people will hear everything I'm saying today or some other expert, and then they don't do it. They just don't do it. You have to have enough internal fortitude to, like I said, first recognize that there's a problem, then recognize there is a solution to this problem. I just don't know what that is yet. But then recognize it's going to take effort to find that solution. And it's going to take effort to probably implement that solution to work through whatever I need to work through, you know? So to me, those are the biggest keys, because if you can't get past those three stages of recognizing it, of beginning to search out a solution, and then once you've found one, figuring out a plan of how I'm going to implement it. If you can't get to that stage, nothing ever changes, right? Nothing changes. And you can become, you know, what most of us will call like have a victim mentality, or there's a lot of different ways to categorize that behavior, but where your circumstances constantly drive what you're experiencing in life rather than you being solution oriented and looking for ways to flip that and turn it into an opportunity for growth and an opportunity for you to move in another direction. You know, I think a great example of that, and one of the some people aren't going to like this statement I'm about to make, but as much as I hate so many things about what the pandemic did and the loss of life, and still we're talking about mental wellness, the toll that it's taken on mental wellness on so many people, we haven't even seen really the beginning of it, in my opinion. But despite that, there were some good things that I think came out of that experience. And one of those is just simply this. I have talked to so many people now over the last couple of years that were just in this rhythm of life that most of us would say is just being in a rut, or just living a mediocre life. And something about that experience going through the pandemic made them realize, you know what? I need to make some serious changes. No one's guaranteed tomorrow. No one's guaranteed what the world's going to look like tomorrow, right? I mean, things changed on all of us like that. So I'm going to be the one who's going to begin to be the aggressor in chasing the kind of life that I want to live, rather than constantly letting life control me. And I do think that's one positive thing that's, you know, come out of what we all experienced.
Where do you want to see your mission in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because it's been something that's it's ongoing, and it's kind of morphed as I've begun to figure. And by the way, I hope this is a word of encouragement to everybody too, because, you know, there are definitely some people, and there are systems that you can go by, and, you know, there's people that are so concrete in exactly the answer to that question. They know exactly what it needs to look like and exactly how to go about it. And they do that. And that's awesome. But a lot of times our greatest successes in life come through trial and error, and we kind of bob and weave, and we start out thinking it's going to be one thing, and it, you know, it becomes something else, and that's still a beautiful thing. And so that part of my answer to that is that's partly where I'm at. It's beginning to shift. And so for me, the next 3 to 5 years, one for me personally, you know, the doors have begun to open, and I'm getting much more involved in the corporate world of, you know, culture development, coping mechanisms with trauma and mental health and wellness and things like that. I really believe that I'm going to be able to work deeply in those environments over the next 3 to 5 years and really be able to help so many people that I never would have been helped doing it the way I was doing it before. And there's some people are going to require some explanation of what I'm talking about, knowing that I was a pastor. You know, when I was a pastor, I was inside the four walls. And so with my roles, I pretty much just dealt with a very small community of people over and over and over and over and over and over again. Now, those people went out, but most of my days were spent just doing that. Well, where are most people in the world? They're somewhere in the workforce, right? Yeah. I mean, they're somewhere out there. And so, you know, I've found that this has been such a cool lane to be in that from like my work with Excellent Cultures, for example, you know, where we're the trajectory that we're on right now with the companies that we work with. I mean, some of our clients are, we have the president of Toyota, we've got guys high up in Microsoft, we work with smaller companies too. So I don't want to imply that we'll only work with the big dogs. We work with smaller companies as well because we're more mission driven. But we're able to help them create healthier cultures within the infrastructure of their business. And yes, we have data and scientific assessments and different things that we do, some that are proprietary, that bring them the ROI that they're looking for. So there is numbers involved and there is, you know, revenue increase and all those things. But those things are happening because they're creating healthier ecosystems, cultures within their companies that are allowing everyone to thrive and to embrace their own creative genius and advance. In some cases, maybe leave their company because now they're going to go start their own thing or whatever. So I'm super excited about the trajectory of where we're going with building cultures and some of the relationships I built through that. And then also for me, you know, I've been a speaker for really almost 25 years now. I did some stuff before I even got into the church world. And so I love that. And I've had some really cool opportunities to be able to get in there and be inspirational. So I want to see that continue to grow. I know that sounds kind of self-serving in that I'm talking about me, but you know, there's something in me that I know moves the needle with people, gets them thinking differently, that can, and I share tools that I didn't create. They're not mine, but I share things that really do help people. And so I'm really believing over this, you know, next 3 to 5 years that my ability to reach more people is going to grow. I've got some things cooking right now that I'm not comfortable talking about with yet because they're not signed on the dotted line yet, but I've got some partnerships forming, some with, if I were to say who with, everybody would pretty much know who they are. So there's some neat things happening. And that actually is part of my answer as well, is over the next 3 to 5 years, I want to be collaborating more than I am today. I really believe that's the greatest sign of success. There's other characteristics that go into success, but to me, the greatest sign of it is collaboration. Why do I say that? Because it's not enough just for me to make a great living and me be known more than I am today. And, you know, me, and look at me, look at what I'm doing. You know, the greatest things in life that we can see and touch and smell and feel all come through collaboration. You know, the greatest musical acts of all time. I love watching documentaries about musical groups and how they work with producers. And, you know, you can take the most singularly famous person you can think of in any industry, really. But I'm just going to stick with music for a second. And we may think, oh, yeah, well, let's throw Taylor Swift out there because, like, she needs more, you know, exposure. But great example. You know, I think of her. Well, Taylor Swift wouldn't be Taylor Swift without collaborating with likely hundreds of people behind the scenes that help her do what she can do. And so that's part of my 3 to 5 year goal as well, is I want to be collaborating with even more really high quality people. In many cases, and some I'm already doing it now, I have no benefit, no direct benefit of whatsoever, other than I get to help them do their thing in a more effective way and get to see them succeed. And then some of those collaborations are mutually beneficial as well. So I hope that answered your question. I don't really, I'm not one of those numbers people. I'm not going to start throwing out a bunch of analytics and I want to grow to this amount. And so I probably disappointed some of our listeners, but that's my answer.
How can people reach out to you and learn more?
Yeah, well, the best way to reach out to me is to go to my website because it's kind of one-stop shopping. That's bigboldbrave.us. Within that, you can find pretty much everything else I'm doing. You can find my social media platforms if you want to join me there. I have a weekly newsletter that I send out every single week that a lot of people like, that, you know, just quick content, just bite-sized stuff that can help move the needle for them every single day. Doesn't, you know, doesn't cost anything to do it. They can find my book there, Big, Bold, Brave, How to Live Courageously in a Risky World. You can also find that on Amazon, everywhere else as well. But if they go to my website, bigbullbrave.us, I say bigbullbrave.us, they can find me for speaking engagements, my work with Excellent Cultures, you know, all of that stuff. So that's the easy button.